Welcome to Zero Knowledge. I'm your host, Anna Rose. In this podcast, we will be exploring the latest in zero knowledge research and the decentralized web, as well as new paradigms that promise to change the way we interact and transact online. This week, Guillermo and I chat with Justin Thaler, associate professor at Georgetown and research partner at A16Z. Last year, he published a blog post called The 17 Misconceptions About Snarks, which made waves in the ZK space. And in this episode, we revisit a few select points. We then dive into Jolt, a new ZK VM, which had been initially described along with Lasso in 2023 and has recently been implemented and is open to contributions from the community. We talk about how his work on some check protocols influenced this work, how it compares to others in the space, and more. Now, before we kick off, I just want to share a little bit about ZK Hack Krakow, an upcoming IRL hackathon happening May 17th through 19th in Krakow. ZK Hack is an educational hub and another project that I'm a part of. We actually mentioned that on this episode with Justin because Justin's been running a long-standing study group over on the ZK Hack Discord. But ZK Hack also does IRL events, and as mentioned, the next one coming up is on May 17th through 19th, and it's happening in Krakow. We already have an amazing group of hackers set to join us, some fantastic sponsors offering prizes, a great venue, and we're hoping that this event, like our previous hackathons, showcases the next generation of ZK applications. So if you're in the field or looking to jump in, I hope you'll join us as well. I've added the link in the show notes. Now, Tanya will share a little bit about this week's sponsors.
Aleo is a new Layer 1 blockchain that achieves the programmability of Ethereum, the privacy of Zcash, and the scalability of a rollup. Driven by a mission for a truly secure internet, Aleo has interwoven zero-knowledge proofs into every facet of their stack, resulting in a vertically integrated Layer 1 blockchain that's unparalleled in its approach. Aleo is ZK by design. Dive into their programming language Leo and see what permissionless development looks like, offering boundless opportunities for developers and innovators to build ZK apps. This is an invitation to be part of a transformational ZK journey. Dive deeper and discover more about Aleo at aleo.org.
Nemata is the shielded asset hub rewarding you to protect the multi-chain. Built to give you full control over sharing your personal information, Nemata brings data protection to existing assets, applications, and networks. Nemata ends the era of transparency by default, enabling shielded transfers and shielded cross-chain actions to protect your data even when interacting with transparent chains. Nemata also introduces a novel shielding rewards system. By holding your assets in a shielded set, you help strengthen Nemata's data protection guarantees and collect NAM rewards in return. Nemata will initially support IBC and Ethereum-based assets, but will ultimately serve as a single shielded hub for all assets across the multi-chain. Learn more and follow Nemata mainnet launch at nemata.net.
Today, Guillermo and I are here with Justin Thaler. Welcome back to the show, Justin.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Hey, Guillermo.
Hey.
Justin, last time you were on the show, I introduced you as an associate professor at Georgetown. Now I think you have another kind of role we can talk about, which is research partner at A16Z, or Z. Sorry, that was so Canadian. but yeah, it's really great to have you back on the show. And I want to talk about what's happened since you've been on.
Sounds good.
So you joined A16Z. Tell us a little bit about that. What's it like working there and what are you doing there?
Sounds good. Yeah, I think last time I was on was just a few weeks before I started full time. So I got started there right when the research group started. They ran like a few months after, you know, like day one, summer hit, and the group was, I think, four people to start. And they brought in a whole bunch of visitors for the summer, really spanning the blockchain, you know, discipline, a bunch of cryptographers, economists, even political scientists, a mix of PhD students and professors. So I was there actually just for about half the summer. And it was, you know, super exciting, just like drinking from a fire hose. I guess Tim Refgarden, who runs the group, was trying to model the summer after the Simons Institute for the Theory of Computing at UC Berkeley, that runs these like, you know, semester-long focuses on a research topic. And also there, it's just like there's so much activity, you just like can't keep up. You have to actually be careful. You have time to like talk and think and do work rather than just like consume the content that is, you know, occurring and being produced. So that was just a great experience, kind of sucked me deeper into sort of efforts to, you know, deploy these SNARKs, deploy these ZK proofs. Yeah, I think it sort of cut both ways. You know, excitement in this technology was, you know, already high and rising. So I think there was a lot of interest both in the firm to have someone with my expertise there. And I was super excited to be more involved. So I started full time in January. I'm on leave from Georgetown right now. I'm still able to sort of get my fix for teaching. I'm still running my reading group over Discord on the ZK Hack channel.
Yes. And
planning to start a brand new fresh pass through my book soon, hopefully in the next couple of weeks. So I've been off Discord for a few weeks, but I'll get back on and sort of announce that soon.
Nice.
And yeah, it's been a wonderful, it's been a little over a year now, going on a year and a half. And you know, there's so much just excitement about blockchains and SNARKs in particular throughout the firm. You know, my colleagues in the research group are wonderful, and I've gotten to work very closely with this engineering team that's there as well, which has also just been like a dream come true for me. And that's sort of what's led to the recent Jolt implementation that we'll probably talk about today. So I'll say more about that then, but it's just been a wonderful experience overall.
Who's on that team with you? Are there any names we know? Yeah, and I mean, some of these folks, actually, I know some folks from your group presented at ZK10.
Yeah. So so you probably know very well Joe Bonneau, who's a, he's kind of a generalist cryptographer. He kind of co-authored the first book, as I understand it, on kind of the science of blockchains and, you know, the cryptography underlying blockchains in particular.
Yeah, he's been on the show before, too, actually.
I've had him as a guest. Yeah. Yeah, and he's done really groundbreaking works like, you know, introducing the notion of EDFs and, you know, with colleagues and things like that. So Valeria Nikolenko is on the team, and she does a lot of work with signatures and MPC and, you know, uses SNARKs as well in some of her research. So we kind of form like the cryptographers of the group. And the others are economists. So there's Tim Refgarden. There's Scott Kaminars, who's at Harvard Business School. Pranav Garamidi and Miriam Barani. You know, so Tim and Scott are faculty. Miriam and Pranav are sort of full-time grad student level researchers, essentially. But you know, there's like no separation at all in the group. You know, kind of everybody is works together and the same. And we also have you know, Dan Bonnet is closely affiliated with the group.
I was gonna ask. Yeah. I know he's been involved with this for a while, right?
Yeah. So he's not full time or anything like that, but he's closely involved. You know, we talk to him weekly and he visits over the summer. And there's also a political scientist closely affiliated with the group, Andy Hall. We sort of get him for one day a week. And he works a lot on like governance of you know, DAOs and blockchain protocols and stuff. And I expect the group to continue to grow and add more areas and branch out as we go. There, you know, a postdoc, Joachim New is joining soon. And he's very broad, but he does topics like consensus research and things like that. So just a wonderful group, and the, you know, works very closely with other parts of the firm that it's just been a fantastic experience. I sort of can't believe, you know, my luck at getting to be a part of it.
It sounds like there's also an engineering team. And actually the folks who've spoken at ZK10, at ZK Summit 10, I don't think you've mentioned them yet. They're the folks you work on with, like on Jolt and stuff. Who are they? How big is that team?
Yeah, so there's an engineering team. I think it's roughly the size of the research group. So I think I listed, you know, depending on who you count, like 6 to 8 people, and the engineering group is in that vicinity. I've never actually counted on my hands.
Got it.
And yeah, they have dual roles, just like the research group doesn't just do research. So that, you know, that they help the portfolio companies a lot to the, you know, to the extent possible. They also work on developing open source tools, you know, for the whole community to use. All sorts of other things in the firm as well. And so it's been a real, real pleasure to, you know, have Jolt kind of be one of the main sort of open source efforts and to be involved with that. Yeah, it's just been very exciting and productive, I think.
Cool. You just mentioned your book, Proofs, Arguments, and Zero Knowledge Proofs. I want to just sort of mention this before we dive into any of the topics we wanted to cover today. I think you've run three cohorts of a study group in the ZK Hack Discord. I know last time we had you on the show, we talked a lot about that and like that book and where it came from and where it was at. So I'll definitely link to that episode if people want to just learn about this book you've written, or actually you called it a mono, what was it called?
Monograph.
Monograph.
Monograph. Monograph. Yeah. We could just call it a book now, I guess, that it's been...
I think it's a book now. I think it's officially a book, not a monograph.
It's gone through peer review three times. So, I mean, yes, exactly. Some form of peer review. So I know what you mentioned in that episode was that you, like, by doing these study groups, you actually get to see how the book is interpreted by people who are reading it for the first time often. And through that, you've been able to make it, like, refine it and change it. You were just saying you're going to run another one. This is very cool. I just want to kind of highlight that because I think people are going to be into it.
How long is it again? How many weeks?
How many weeks? Yeah, I mean, it varies based on like basically how many off weeks we need to take. But
I see.
One pass through the book normally takes about like 8 months, it seems, at this point.
Wow.
Okay. This is like not messing around type.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, I apologize. I've never done one of them. I did like a very, very short session at some point, which was like 3 days or something.
Yeah, you did a study group mini.
Yeah.
Guillermo. Justin's proofs, arguments, and zero knowledge proofs are the ZK hack study group, like maxi for sure.
Damn, I should do that. I should just, one of these days, should just do it. It'd be kind of fun.
I think it might be cool. The longest one. We did do, there was a group that did the Moon Math Manual, and they also spent like at least 6 months. But I think yours may still be the longest running one. And definitely the longest.
Who's writing Moon Math?
Well, it's a book. It was produced by the Least Authority Group, and Mirko was the author. But they, like, in our group, they've just read through it. So, like, you know, there's a facilitator, and together the group kind of reads a chapter every week and then gets together. They're actually running the Moon Math Manual again right now. And the whiteboard study group. There's a lot of study groups going on in ZK Hack if people aren't aware. Definitely go check that out. And I guess, Justin, if you're going to start yours off soon, this is kind of the perfect time to let people know.
So sometime in May, I plan to start it up again. And one benefit of actually coming to the sessions, or we try to record them and get them on YouTube, although I don't actually track if they make their way to YouTube or not. But, you know, there are a lot of questions about, like, what people are actually building, you know, specific systems and things, which isn't discussed as much in the book, or, you know, certainly the book can't keep up to date with, like, you know, the many changes to, you know, what people are building, like every month or so forth. So you sort of get that benefit. And, you know, I do my best to keep up and give accurate answers. It's hard if with how much things changes, but, so that's a benefit of the sessions over just reading the book, I think. And also the book is now already, you know, out of date in certain ways. So that's another benefit showing up.
Interesting. Since you've been on, you also published this essay called 17 Misconceptions About Snarks. And I feel like that really made the rounds in our community. It definitely impacted me a little bit. The first point is using ZK to mean succinct. I think it was the first time, for me at least, it was very clearly articulated that we've been saying it wrong when we say ZK snarks. We're often actually describing snarks that are not ZK. And yet it's all been lumped under the ZK umbrella. And we've talked about this a few times on the show. And I think there's kind of now like an acceptance of we're still going to keep using the term. But I think you were the first person to really, for me at least, like make that distinction very clear.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I was not the first person from my perspective, right? I was, I think people were talking about this before I, you know, put it in the post. I guess one point I'm not sure I had heard much before that, you know, which is maybe my main concern is that, you know, ZK has a precise technical meaning about basically protecting privacy of the witness. And so my main concern is that one day, you know, someone calls something ZK, it's not ZK. And so there's like a privacy leak. And that's really my main concern. I mean, I do think it's helpful to be precise about like what property of a proof system you really care about. And often it is succinctness and not the ZK property. I also just like the word succinct, but I know it's like not going to that's not going to catch on quite the same way ZK has. So
I think succinctness has, I mean, it's emerged a lot more. I think people do use the term more since you've published this blog post and definitely in the last year. But yeah, I think it's that big umbrella term ZK still seems to hold.
Yeah. And I expect it will. And I don't think it's the end of the world as long as more people are aware of the way it's being used, right? I mean, I've also like talked to people who, you know nothing about SNARKs and got very confused about this. So that was another concern.
Yeah.
Oh no.
So if there's more awareness, I guess that can help. And also like now I think people will say ZK and then be more prepared to clarify that they don't actually mean ZK. And that can also help. So
yeah.
I'm not going to be super rigid here, but I think it was definitely useful to say something.
I think the like crappy version of this that I have in my head is like ZK, the acronym is like a different type than like zero knowledge, right? Like ZK, the acronym is like, it just means like vaguely everything, unless it is combined with a secondary thing. But like when you say zero knowledge, you really do mean zero knowledge.
That's it. You know, I actually haven't heard that before. So that distinction. So maybe I'll feel, I'm going to, you know, now every time somebody says it, I'm going to think like, did they say zero knowledge or did they say ZK? And maybe it'll be okay.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's like a people problem, right? As opposed to, it's like, what kind of person is this? You know, who would say that, right?
Looking at these 17, I will not go through all of them because, well, first of all, some of them are too in the weeds. I don't fully understand all of them, but I do want, I went through and highlighted a few of these because when did you publish this blog post, actually? It's like a year ago, right?
Yeah, something like that. I remember it was a couple months before, you know, the Lasso Joel papers came out, and those are already 7-8 months ago. So yeah, like a little under a year ago, 10 months, something like that, yeah.
I sort of mentioned the first point, which was using ZK to mean succinct. Another point you made was sort of the SNARKs versus STARKs, which I also think in the time, I mean, I think it was already happening when you wrote this, obviously, but I think in the time since, I think that blending of those things and that sense that like, neither, you know, I think I've asked this on a recent podcast, like which one wins and it's like both or neither, like they're a mix in a way now. So it's hard to make that distinction.
Yes, and I think they'll sort of get blended even more as with recent developments with like, you know, Binius now having, you know, polylogarithmic proof size without recursion and things like that. So, you know, if they blend enough, then, you know, then the whole, I guess, concern goes away that I expressed in the post. But at the time and even today, you know, people often treat them distinctly, you know, when they're not really, because all of these are deployed non-interactively, which does make a STARK technically a special case of a SNARK. And of course, people use STARK to also mean a particular protocol as opposed to, you know, any protocol satisfying a class of properties, which is, you know, really how the term was defined in the research literature. I guess my two biggest concerns, one was mentioned in the post, which is the acronym STARK in the research literature actually doesn't specify if the protocol is non-interactive or interactive.
Okay.
And whether it's non-interactive or interactive drastically affects the appropriate security level of the protocol. And so I find this kind of very, I almost call it dangerous, where if you talk about what's the right security of STARKs, is this, you know, number of bits of security appropriate? Well, firstly, bits of security is a sort of underspecified term, but even ignoring that, the answer is completely different depending on whether it's deployed interactively or non-interactively. But today, they're exclusively deployed non-interactively. So that was one concern. You know, something I didn't say in the post that I keep encountering since the post, people think STARKs also encompasses post-quantum security, but the term as defined says nothing about post-quantum security. Anyway, I mean, I think that, you know, this distinction, which is not really a distinction in practice, has caused a lot of confusion. I'd like to stop the confusion.
But which one do you choose, Justin? What do you call this thing now?
So, my preference, as I said in the post, as long as these are all deployed non-interactively, a snark is a transparent snark with certain efficiency properties. Mm-hmm. So let's just say snark. And if you want to emphasize that it's transparent, let's say it's a transparent snark. And it's kind of leave it at that. That's my view. Obviously, there's going to be all sorts of disagreement about this. It's a pretty controversial topic, but
I actually have two questions for you. I feel like snark and stark have become like tasting notes. You know, it's like you use it to like gesture at something that vaguely feels like appropriate, but it's not quite like a real distinction in any like, you know, deep way.
Is that a wine reference, Guillermo?
Me making wine references in public? That's crazy.
Tasting notes?
Absolutely. No, I would never do such a thing.
A hint of oak. Okay.
Yeah, a nice bit of nightiness right here, you know. But I do want to like, I'm curious about this notion, and this is probably really obvious. It's not super obvious to me, which is you said that snarks in the non-interactive setting have non-obvious security properties. Again, you know, explain it to me like I'm a five-year-old that happens to know a lot of math, but is otherwise an idiot.
So, right. Okay. So I think you're asking about this distinction I was drawing between appropriate security levels when a protocol is deployed interactively versus non-interactively.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So,
and
right.
Which one is more secure, actually, in that?
Yeah. I mean, it's not really a more or less secure. So let me just explain. So, when people refer to bits of security for a snark, okay, roughly what they mean is the logarithm of the minimum number of steps, computational steps required to attack the snark, so to find a convincing proof of a false statement, okay? When people say bits of security, when they're talking about an interactive proof system, essentially what they mean typically is what is the maximum success probability that the prover can achieve on like any given run of the protocol, like regardless of how long it runs for. Okay. And even this can vary a bit, but so it's like with an interactive protocol, it's like, you know, no matter how much work the prover puts in, it might be the case that it has like a one in a trillion chance of convincing the verifier to accept a false statement. And, you know, that probability is so low because, you know, at the very last second, the verifier chooses a random value, which the prover just doesn't know until all its messages are sent, right?
Correct.
So in that setting, it might be reasonable to have the prover have like a one in a trillion chance of tricking the verifier, you know, because it doesn't know if it's going to succeed until it actually runs the protocol. And, you know, with probability one minus one over a trillion, the verifier rejects and like everyone in the world sees that, you know, this was a cheating prover and it got rejected, right? Whereas in the non-interactive case, you know, the attack can happen silently, like kind of offline. The prover is just sort of doing in its own head like a kind of a linear search over possible proofs until it finds one that the verifier accepts. So it's just very different settings. And so in this non-interactive setting where, you know, the attack happens silently in the prover's head and no one knows it's happening, you know, I think you really want like minimum 100 bits of security if you're protecting anything of value. You know, if you really want the attack to be truly infeasible today and have a little bit of buffer in case better attacks are discovered, I even prefer more than 100 bits of security, but I won't complain about 100 bits. In the interactive sure. setting, could be totally fine to be, yes. you know, way, way, way fewer number of bits of security.
No, sure. Yeah. Right. In the interactive setting, right, like one in a trillion is good enough, right? But in the non-interactive setting, it gets. So I see. So the point fundamentally. Mentally, difference is like one can carry an offline attack in the non-interactive case.
Pretty much, that's the difference,
right? Versus in the other one, like you, in a pure probabilistic sense, right? Like this, the sampling is happening independent of whatever you do, so you're screwed. And so that is the argument for saying like, hey, look, we might want to extend the amount of security for the offline case or the non-interactive case.
Right. I think, you know, everyone agrees that like, you know, 40 bits of security, that's like one over a trillion, is like completely insecure in the non-interactive case.
Right.
But could be totally fine in the interactive case. So I'd really like a term, you know, to be precise about which of the two cases we're discussing, because I think security is way more important than performance. Mm-hmm. And as I prefer the term to be precise about that. And, you know, technically the Stark term is not precise. And actually, I think that had confused discussion significantly. And this was one of the, when I started looking more closely at what people were doing in practice, at, you know, I was at my first summer at A16Z, you know, and I wrote this blog post. I actually had a couple people reach out to me after the post, not the 17 misconceptions post, another post about security, saying that they thought that some Starks had been deployed interactively, and hence, you know, 80 bits of security was plenty, a huge amount of security. And that was not true. And if these individuals didn't know what projects were doing, like no one does other than the projects themselves, right? I mean, I found it actually quite disturbing that, you know, basically these things were ostensibly protecting quite a bit of value, and actually nobody knew apparently what was really the protocol was doing. So that was that sort of inspired me to try to talk about it.
I see.
Makes sense. I'm going to keep going through this list with the highlights.
Okay. Sounds good.
Number five was Snarks targeting R1CS cannot support lookup arguments. I'm assuming that this is potentially in reference to the work that you then started to do on Lasso?
Partially. I'd say this... this one kind of fed into a paper I have on customizable constraint systems, which predates like Lasso and Jolt. And actually, you know, is for ZKVMs is actually rendered irrelevant by Lasso and Jolt, basically because Jolt avoids constraint systems almost entirely. The constraint systems that it does use are so simple that it really doesn't matter what kind of constraint system you use. We use R1CS, but like really they're just like the simplest constraints you can come up with. You can kind of use anything. But the customizable constraint systems paper was sort of pointing out a couple things. Basically, known sumcheck-based snarks, Spartan in particular, just sort of directly supports not only R1CS, which is how, you know, it was described for R1CS, but like, you know, you don't need any new ideas. You just have to understand the protocol, and you'll see it actually can prove statements about much more expressive constraint systems. And that's sort of, you know, CCS, customizable constraint systems, are sort of what we thought was the cleanest and most expressive constraint system that, you know, something like Spartan could prove statements about. But yeah, there were some works that were, you know, developing sumcheck-based snarks, also looking at non-sumcheck-based snarks for R1CS, and sort of didn't let the sumcheck-based snarks for R1CS have access to the lookup arguments.
I see.
Right. And so they, you know, claimed significant speed improvements over, you know, something like Spartan, when I think the speed improvements are really just due to the fact that they didn't let Spartan use lookups, and they did let, you know, the new stuff use lookups.
Okay.
So that's the point I was trying to highlight there. And, you know, now, of course, that Jolt is all, you know, sumcheck based and, you know, uses Spartan for R1CS and everything else is lookups. I don't think, you know, any of this is unclear anymore. But at the time of the misconceptions post, I think it was unclear.
I should also say the sentences I'm saying, you are arguing in this article that these are incorrect, that Snark targeting R1CS cannot support lookup arguments is an incorrect statement.
Right.
Yeah. Another incorrect statement that you believe is incorrect is believing that Fiat-Shamir transformations generally lead to no major loss of security except when applied to the sequential repetition of a base protocol. That actually has come up on episodes since. The Fiat-Shamir transformation as a place of potential security loss. And that's just interesting that you brought that up back then.
Even for me, can you like unpack that sentence in like a nice way? I think I know what it is. Like I can map it to something that I understand, but.
And just to say it again, like the misconception, like he's saying here, people believe that there is no loss of security when using Fiat-Shamir, but that is incorrect.
Yeah, so I'm happy for the opportunity to say something here because actually I think the blog post, this is sort of buried in the post, is very technical. I think it's really good to speak about it right now. So Fiat-Shamir can lead to security issues in two ways. Okay, one is basically like it's just not implemented right. And this comes up over and over and over again. And I mentioned it sort of as a PSA in the post, but like people have been aware of this for a long time and somehow the mistake kept happening. For Fiat-Shamir to be secure, you have to Fiat-Shamir hash anything that the adversary might control. And often people don't do that. And that makes it attackable. Okay. And so people will call that weak fiat shamir. I mean, I think we should just maybe just say, like, that's not fiat shamir. Like, don't do that. But we people call it weak fiat shamir.
I've heard that. Yeah. But like, I've heard it just like used. Do people just use weak fiat shamir sometimes?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure why anybody would intentionally do it, just because fiat shamir hashing is like rarely a bottleneck. So I don't know why you would want to kind of risk, you know, I think the general message for practitioners is like, when in doubt, hash it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some settings where, you know, if you're hashing like a whole description of a constraint system and the constraint system has no short description, like that can be really gross. But typically it's not a bottleneck. So like, when in doubt, hash it. If the adversary might control it, hash it. And so that, you know, that's really just a bug that some practitioner, you know, some papers, you know, forgot to write down, like, you know, hash this as well. And so, you know, people implemented like the paper word for word. And so Trail of Bits, you know, discovered, you know, this bug in a bunch of snarks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depending on context, this might or might not be a completely catastrophic vulnerability. Paul Grubbs and his colleagues had a paper. Paul Grubbs is a faculty at Michigan. Recently, you know, looking at kind of a systematic look at like snark implementations, and found, you know, this bug like all over the place. And I believe actually found another exploitable deployment of this bug. Anyway, so that is one major way fiat shamir can lead to loss of security. That is not what this item of the post is about. Okay. This item of the post is about the fact that even if you do implement it correctly, the number of bits of security in sort of the interactive sense of the protocol you're applying fiat shamir to, you know, to make it non-interactive, you know, often people just assume that, you know, the fiat shamir protocol has the same number of bits of security as, you know, the interactive one you started with, right? And as we discussed before, like these two words, bits of security for interactive and bits of security for non-interactive, don't necessarily mean the same thing. But yeah, so they assume it's the same number. And it's not always the case. And so there's really like a canonical example where there actually is just a catastrophic loss of security, even when you implement fiat shamir correctly, which is you take a protocol with like one bit of security, you amplify the number of bits of security by repeating it in sequentially, you know, once, then twice, then a third time, then a fourth time, right? That drives the security down to say 128 bits of security if you repeat 128 times, and then you fiat shamir that. That won't be secure at all. And like, people do know that.
Is there an easy explanation to see why it's not secure?
There's a simple attack. It's sort of called a grinding attack, but like basically in the interactive setting, the prover would have to sort of get lucky on all 128 repetitions all at once.
That's right.
Has to get lucky all at once. But once you fiat shamir it, you can sort of attack the first iteration like independently of all the others, and it'll only take like a couple of attempts to succeed, you know, to find a convincing proof just for that iteration.
I see. And then you can continue grinding the rest.
Yeah. It's like you defeat one and then the next and then the next, and you don't have to get lucky all at once.
Got it.
Right. And so, but I think people generally think, oh, well, that's the main thing to be worried about. If you're not doing sequential repetition, you know, and you do strong fiat shamir, not weak fiat shamir, you should be fine. This post is pointing out that there's a really subtle and an amazing attack, which I learned about from a paper of Atema et al. And through the folks from Nethermind, which I have a paper with, which I'll sort of plug briefly, but I think they discussed it on this podcast at some point.
Totally. I was about to say, this is where I think we covered exactly that. We'll try to dig that up, the Nethermind episode. Yep.
Wonderful. So I just recently talked to a couple experts recently who were like blown away by this attack. Like they literally read my post. They didn't quite understand the attack in the post. And then I, you know, sketched it for them over email, and they were like, oh my God. So this is when you take a multi-round protocol, and it's crucial, like there has to be two or more rounds. So the attack doesn't work if it's like a, you know, just two messages. It's got to be like, you know, three or four or more messages. You know, say it has 64 bits of security. You're not happy with that. You know, because if you fiat shamir it, like that's not secure. So you repeat it in parallel twice to get 128 bits of security.
Okay.
Right. And then you fiat shamir that. Okay. So this is not sequential repetition, it's parallel repetition. And then fiat shamir.
Okay.
That doesn't work.
So here's a first dumb question is, what does it mean to fiat shamir two parallel instances? What is the initial hash?
Right. So the parallel repetition of the base protocol is just a new, you know, interactive protocol. Forget about fiat shamir. So it's like you have a protocol with 64 bits of security. You want to reduce that or improve that to 128 bits of security. So rather than like running it once and then running it again, you're going to run it twice, sort of, you know.
Yeah, like simultaneously or something.
Yeah, exactly. That is a new interactive protocol. It has the same number of rounds as the original protocol, unlike the sequential repetition where you would have doubled the number of rounds. Yeah. This is the same number of rounds. Mm-hmm. Okay, now Fiat Shamir that. You know, that's just an interactive protocol. It makes sense to Fiat Shamir it, Fiat Shamir that. That will be no more secure than if you hadn't done the repetition at all.
If you hadn't done that parallelization, basically.
Right. If you hadn't done the repetition, like literally the repeating it once, as long, if you started with a two-round protocol, you repeated it once, like in parallel, you know, so there's two repetitions in parallel, and you fiat shamir it, you might as well have not done the repetition at all.
Interesting. Mm. Okay.
And again, the attack is very simple. It roughly amounts to attacking the first repetition on its own. You sort of, you know, use round one, like the first verifier challenge, to attack one of the two repetitions. And, you know, you only need like about 2^64 attempts before you, you know, defeat one of the two. You're not going to defeat both of them at once. You're only going to defeat one of them. Mm-hmm. But then you still have another round left to attack the other repetition. And I know you don't get all the details mm-hmm. when I'm saying this on the fly. But I'm going to try to go back to the misconceptions post and add just, I think, a little picture of, you know, the two rounds repeated.
Right. Because the point is like, okay, like, fundamentally, what's going on is like, you know, these sequential constructions, these parallel constructions can always be reduced to just like, instead of kind of attacking this like much larger space, like square of the size, actually what you're doing is you're doing something like two times the size, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. of the fact that like you can exploit this, the structure of it such that like, you know, instead of having like many parallel instances, each of which is independent. In reality, what you have is we have a single instance, which is like sequential, and they're all fundamentally like sequential in some way, right? And so like it just requires that you attack like a single independent instance, and so you only need 2^64 at any point in time.
Yeah.
Or like attempts or whatever.
I think that's the right, that's the right intuition, yeah. And so, you know, and the general message of you know, this part of my blog post, I mean, mainly it's a PSA because right. this is like a huge foot garden where someone at some point is like going to blow their foot off unless everyone is aware
That's
of it. The kind of the right way to use Fiat Shamir in practice is to first show that the thing you're applying Fiat Shamir to satisfies a stronger soundness notion than like just standard soundness called round by round soundness. And this captures the intuition that if the prover in the interactive protocol kind of has to get lucky all at once, like in one round, like it can sort of get a little lucky in the first round and then a little more lucky in the second round.
I see.
You know, then when you apply Fiat Shamir, it's fine. You know, there's no loss of security. And so with the Nethermind folks and, you know, my postdoc, Alex Block and others, we showed that like Fry is round by round sound. It actually hadn't been shown before. So we actually didn't know, you know, in the random Oracle model that like Fiat Shamir'd Fry was sound. It's not that I actually thought it wasn't, but it, you know, we should know that it is at least in the random Oracle model. And then actually, you know, a group from Starkware kind of showed the same thing, basically the same result around the same time. And, you know, with Nethermind, we had some other results that, you know, other things people were doing that, you know, potentially could have been attackable because they had more than one round, are also round by round sound. And so, you know, it's all okay, right? There was no like new attack in the protocol. We were just sort of, you know, showing that Fiat Shamir was safe when it hadn't actually been shown before.
Here's a very quick dumb question before we move on to the next point is what is like the intuition for round by round sound? I know you said like, oh, you can't get too lucky. And like, essentially you can't like get lucky in one and then get a little bit lucky in the next. And then like at some point, like that adds, what is the like it more clear definition of it? I don't know if there is
one. I mean,
I'm just curious.
Yeah, I guess that is most of my intuition. I mean, I think it sort of rules out this, you know, sequential repetition canonical example, you know, and if the prover just has to, you know, it has a probability of half of getting lucky in the first repetition and then, it, you know, a half of getting lucky in the second repetition and so on. And so, you know, it can kind of get a little bit lucky in each repetition. And that's exactly the situation where this grinding attack mm-hmm. on Fiat Shamir works, where, you know, yeah. And round by round sound basically says that grinding attack can't work.
Got it.
Because
okay. It's just essentially like the definition is explicitly to rule this like particular attack out rather than like.
That's my interpretation of it. That's my intuition.
All right, I'm going to move on to misconception number 14.
14, all right.
So we are skipping, like, as I mentioned, I selected a few of them. Okay. I have two more. So just before you mentioned Binius briefly, number 14 was the misconception is the key to better performing snarks is working over ever smaller fields. Mm-hmm. And did they prove you wrong? What happened there?
Great. So this predated Binius. So yeah. A little context there. So Binius was at least partially inspired by Lasso and Jolt. And this post predated Lasso and Jolt, right? So at the time, you know, this was really sort of a fight between elliptic curve-based snarks, meaning, you know, the commitment scheme uses elliptic curves, so the field's big, mm-hmm. and, you know, like hashing-based snarks and, you know, using Fry in particular, and the, you know, the field is small.
The small field folks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Like the plonky threes and stuff.
Yes. And so you could have summed up a lot of my points, but not all of my points. By, you know, me just saying like, hey, curve-based snarks can be faster than the hashing-based snarks, like even though they work over big fields, and, you know, Jolt sort of proves that correct, right? Because it's, you know, at least as fast as the current, you know, like hashing-based EKVMs or what have you. But there's another point I was trying to make, which is that in certain applications, you really don't want to work over the small field because the statement you're proving is sort of natively defined over a big field. And this is, mm-hmm. in particular, this comes up whenever you're proving a statement about elliptic curve cryptography. And so I think, you know, the main application people like always have in mind now is like ZK EVMs. And there a big bottleneck is like Ketchak hashing, say. But if not for that, like another big bottleneck would be proving knowledge of digital signatures. And so if in a world where the hashing wasn't the bottleneck, the signatures were, you actually probably would want to work over, you know, the big fields. And you could imagine a world where, what, you know, one day we're able to get, you know, work over whatever field we want, when we want to, and glue everything together. And then what I'm saying would be right, like big parts of the snark will work over a big field. And then I guess the final thing I'd say is, you know, just the underlying techniques that led me to try to make this point. And really, I was like trying to push back on what I thought was, you know, just a general idea, which, you know, has validity to it, but it's just been taken too far, right? But the techniques that kind of led to the points I'm making, you know, the sum check protocol and all of these things, they led to Binius, right? And so what Binius has done in my view, and this isn't a controversial view, is it's sort of taken the small fields to their extreme, where now the characteristic is two. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't like the small fields term. It's small characteristic. So ultimately, you work over 128-bit field, but it's like, you know, you do as much, you keep as much of the prover's work as possible over the base field or something like that.
So wait, but like, would you still stand by the fact that, going back to the statement, the key to better performing snarks is working over ever smaller fields, being incorrect? That was what you were saying. Would you adjust that?
So I would say two things, okay? So one is, it depends on what you're proving, right? And like this whole thing about proving statements about elliptic curve, you know, cryptography, it's not like some isolated application. It's like, you know, half of blockchains is just like proving, you know, digital signatures authorizing things, right? And like today's digital mm-hmm. signatures are based on elliptic curves. That's like, mm-hmm. That's not like some small thing, right? So it depends on the application. Also, you know, like these folding schemes that get, you know, the overhead of recursion very low. What that basically means is you can break big computations up into really tiny pieces and, you know, prove each piece separately and aggregate the results. And the aggregation step won't be the bottleneck because, you know, the folding lets the recursive aggregation be so fast. Like that can be really important if, like, you know, prover space is a major concern for you. There's been efforts to also do that with hashing-based snarks, but they still have downsides. So, you know, that's another reason the curves could stick around. So I don't think the matter is settled, but I will say I'm like more bullish on the small characteristic fields thanks to, you know, the Binius advancements than I was, you know, when this post came out. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, because that one when I was going through it, definitely like,
that got the most pushback, I think. Yeah, that one got the most pushback. But, you know, ultimately, I think the developments since then have sort of fleshed out what I had in my head a little more. Like I couldn't talk about, you know, like Lasso and Jolt, which I did in my head at the time. You know, they have these nice properties that while they work over a big field, the prover only commits to small values, you know, like numbers between 0 and 2 to 20 or something, like that's a significant performance boost for the techniques that do use the big fields and, you know, heavily exploited to see the performance, you know, out of Jolt that we see today. And that was something I couldn't talk about in this misconceptions post that I can now. So that was something that was in my head that I wasn't able to say in the post.
Was one other thing that maybe didn't factor into your thinking then what like was sort of where hardware would be at? Or were you thinking about hardware?
No, I wasn't thinking about hardware too much. You know, that the small characteristics field does sort of push that point forward heavily, I think. Yeah, these fields are nicer for hardware. I mean, you know, when I was thinking about performance comparisons, like to the extent that existing SNARKs are using vectorization in the small fields, like I had that in my head already. But, you know, I wasn't thinking too much about FPGAs and ASICs, which these small fields also seem friendly to, especially characteristic two.
I mean, I will say, right, like, what is it, like Apple ARM has like an instruction for multiplication of two polynomials like that are like whatever represented by U and date or something like that, right? Like that's like a thing that just like exists on every like Apple computer and iPhone, which is like pretty cool. I think it's for Reed-Solomon encodings actually is what it is, but it has direct applications, of course, to potentially like some of these types of like ZK proofs. So
yeah, even on the CPUs, you know, because AES uses the field 2 to the 128. You know, they have built-in operations. They don't use the same basis for that field that Binius like to use, but you can still leverage it, things like that. The statement that just came out of my mouth, I had no idea about, 10 months ago. That only came from talking to the folks behind Binius, right? That's way deeper knowledge of hardware than I would have any idea of.
I'm gonna see if I can find the like specific instruction, but it's definitely like in the Apple manual somewhere. It's not even that for AES, actually, like for like small multiplications of polynomials, because I think it's specifically for like QR code or something like that, like QR code coding, and some sort of like syndrome decoding type thing. It's very weird. I did not know about this. I think I posted about it in the Discord sometime. But it's like, you know, there's many messages there.
It's fun to just piggyback over these things that came into the hardware for like totally different reasons. It's nice when you can take advantage of it.
The last point was number 17, which is, and I think this might still be true, the misconception being SNARKs are performative enough today that they should now ossify. Do you feel we are any closer to actually getting our standard SNARK or any sort of like subset of a SNARK becoming a standard?
So I do. So first, let me say, I think since this post came out, it's been made clearer, more concrete, like just how slow. I mean, that's my terminology. You could say exactly how fast or slow a lot of SNARKs are. And, you know, in my view, they're too slow, right, for a lot of their intended applications. But I also think they can get a lot faster still. So I'm still hearing this this view that, you know, there's some more performance juice to squeeze, but it's not much. And, you know, we should start focusing on hardware speed ups, focusing on standardizing SNARKs. And I'm actually quite optimistic now that we can reach a point where that might make sense quite soon. I actually didn't think that would necessarily be the case when I wrote this post. But I think we can actually. So, you know, as I've said very recently when discussing like Jolt's performance and other ZKVMs, you know, I think like a ZKVM today is 500,000 times or more slower than just like running the VM without the ZK part, which means the synced, as we've talked about before. But I actually think we can get down to about 10,000 times slower rather than close to a million times slower and fairly soon. And then I think it won't be too slow. And then I think it will make sense to focus on hardware and, you know, if not standardizing, I'm sort of have mixed thoughts about standardizing, but, you know, it's going to take a lot of effort to kind of reach a high level of confidence in the bug freeness of various implementations These are very complicated cryptographic protocols. I mean, people know what I'm saying, that the Ethereum Foundation is launching a competition with $20 million of prizes to push this forward. And so it'd be a lot easier if we sort of converge on not the right snark, but a right snark, so that that effort doesn't have to be repeated over and over and over again. I mean, hopefully we also get better at making the effort like lower and reproducible. Anyway, so yeah, but you know, my view as to that final number 17, you know, that snarks are too slow and can be improved and must be improved, I, you know, is only stronger held view today for me than 10 months ago.
But it sounds like you think we're closer to being able to ossify at least a little bit, at least like hit a step, like a step change where, you know, we probably not forever, but like for a period of time, we kind of like all start using the same thing.
I do. I mean, it might be overly optimistic, but and we could talk about this a little bit later. I mean, I think some of the recent discussion on Twitter, especially like following the release of Jolt, might give the impression that there's more disagreement than there actually is. And I'm actually sensing like a shift where certain views or, you know, techniques I've been advocating for a very long time and like getting very little traction on, actually people seem to be coming around to. And if they do, then, you know, of course I have a view of what I think is the right, you know, the right approach. And if people come around to that, then great, you know, then we've converged. I mean, I'll also say, you know, it's never going to be like one size fits all. Like I think for large enough statements, there'll be a right way to do things. But you'll still have settings, and I've been encountering them in certain applications where, you know, the statement being proved is pretty simple. Like if, you know, you can describe it in a couple million constraints and you want the verifier to be really fast, and there's no room in the application to, you know, kind of aggregate proofs or, you know, prove many of the statements at once. You really have to just prove one small statement and, you know, have the verifier be fast and the proof small. And in that setting, like my preferred techniques don't necessarily help or, you know, make the verifier cost too big and recursion would be a bottleneck or something like that. So you can't, you know, like recurse to bash the verifier cost down. So that will always be an issue. It's never going to be like just like one snark for everything.
Right.
But, you know, most applications, like the statements are at least somewhat big. And then I think we can converge in at least those settings.
It's funny because right now, like everything is like super general purpose. Right. And like we're just like throw the kitchen sink at it. Like we want like this thing to work for everything. But one could imagine like the existence of specific protocols for things that are very common, that are extremely efficient. Like you can provide a sync certificate for it and then verify a sync certificate, you know, in some like very, very efficient way and like a secondary problem. So it is kind of interesting. I feel like it's like right now it's just like this is like the Moore's law thing, right? It's like CPUs. Like CPUs just got better and better and better. And so no, everyone's like, why the hell do you need anything other than a CPU? We just like wait 2 years and like, you know, this thing gets infinitely better. But like at some point we're going to probably develop the GPU and like the, you know, the FPGA version of this where it's like, okay, no, we need to do like this one thing very efficiently because we do this one operation, linear algebra or whatever, 50 million times. Let's get good at that and like, you know, defer a succinct proof of that or a ZK proof or whatever you want to that like, you know, special device for the one specific case where it turns out to be extremely useful.
All right, well, now I think it would be a really good time for us to talk about Jolt and maybe Lasso and Jolt. I know last year when you announced this work, you were kind of, you shared it in a pair. I think it would be great to go into both of these. So, Justin, what is Lasso? What is Jolt?
Great. Yeah, I think Lasso, it's sort of a technical hammer, so I don't think we have to talk too much about it. But back in August or when we sort of announced Lasso and Jolt, like Lasso was implemented and Jolt wasn't.
Okay.
So what is Lasso? It's what's called a lookup argument. And there's sort of two ways to view a lookup argument. They're completely equivalent, but one is it lets the prover, an untrusted prover, commit to a bunch of values and then prove that each of those values lies in some like predetermined lookup table, some predetermined table of values, okay? A completely equivalent way to look at it, really this is equivalent to a variant called what I call index lookup arguments, but the details aren't super important, is it's a way for a prover to prove like very efficiently that a bunch of committed values are all the outputs of a simple function. So it's like the prover commits to, you know, a billion values and then very quickly proves that, you know, for each value that's committed, like that actually equals like f of xi. You know, the ith committed value is f of xi, where, you know, f is known to prover and verifier, and xi is also committed. Okay. So I actually prefer the second view, although it's sort of, I think I'm the only one who takes that view. With that view, it's just, it's a really efficient snark for like super highly data parallel computation. So okay. Evaluating the same simple function f over and over and over and over again. Mm. Okay. Now what Jolt is something called a ZKVM, specifically for something called the RISC-V instruction set. It's a snark that lets a prover prove that it correctly ran a computer program on a witness, where the computer program itself is specified in like RISC-V bytecode, RISC-V assembly. And so this idea of designing a ZKVM for RISC-V was pioneered by a project called RISC-0, which had like incredible foresight to see the major benefits of using an instruction set RISC-V that was not designed by like snark researchers, but rather designed by the computer architecture community, and came with all sorts of great tooling and, you know, compilers and things like that. And so Jolt is basically, you know, just another way of proving like the same statements that RISC-0 is like already proving today and has been proving for, you know, a year or a year and a half or something like that already.
So just so you know, Justin, I don't know if you know this, but like, I mean, I'm an investor in both RISC-0 and Succinct through ZKV and as an angel. And I think, right. Guillermo, you also have...
I'm also an investor in RISC-0. Yeah. So.
we know that group quite well. But actually, I just want to stop you because just before you jump into Jolt in more detail, I actually want to ask you one thing about Lasso and these lookup arguments, because I feel like there's been this line of work. There was, I don't know what the first part of this is, but it's Culk and CQ. I know that's like one line. Mm-hmm. Is Lasso in the same line of work? Is it an addition on CQ or is it using, is it for something else? Is it coming from different, like a different track?
Yeah, great question. So it's inspired by that line of work. I don't know whether to call it part of that line of work or not. So essentially we looked at that line of work, all of those works, starting with Culk. Well, okay, so none of them use the Sumcheck protocol, and some of them seem very specific to KZG commitments in particular, and you know, it's not clear that they would work when KZG commitments don't use fiat-shamir, and it's not clear that they would work if they did use fiat-shamir. So we looked at what was going on in those protocols, and we said, well, let's use Sumcheck.
Okay, and change it for that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like Justin's favorite tool. It's like, how about Sumcheck?
Right. And this is, and by the way, this is, you know, in my view, I've been trying to get people to use Sumcheck for a long time, kind of going on 15 years, like before I even like knew what snarks were really. I was working on half of a snark, you know, snarks without the commitment schemes. And, you know, if, I'll be thrilled if people just start like reaching for Sumcheck. Like they don't have to use Jolt or whatever. I mean, obviously, it'd be even better if they decide to do that. But as long as people start using Sumcheck, I'm thrilled, you know.
Cool.
Yeah, and So we particularly took inspiration from Baloo, which clearly had sort of a matrix vector multiplication going on in there, and then we, you know, like use Sumcheck to prove that matrix vector multiplication. And the way we did that was very similar to something that was happening in the Spartan paper from, you know, the 2019-2020 era. And we just have like a few more observations on top of that to, you know, squeeze some extra performance out, make sure the prover only commits to small values, not big values. So that's Lasso. And it sort of comes with some other nice benefits, like, you know, for a lot of the tables, lookup tables people use in practice, like Lasso is sort of unique, like no one has to commit to the table. You know, I think anything that doesn't use the Sumcheck protocol is not going to have that property. So that's Lasso in a nutshell.
Got it.
Very dumb question here before we get too far. You said it only makes sense for like a simple function f. How do you quantify the simplicity of a function, actually? What does it even mean to be simple here? I know you did early work on this in like a very specific way, which is like polynomial like degree of weird Boolean functions, but I'm just curious what it means here specifically.
I guess the way I'd say it is one way to view Lasso is it from the verifier's perspective, It is a reduction from evaluating F many, 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 many times, you know, like once per lookup, to evaluating F just once. Okay, and really, it's not evaluating F itself. It's evaluating the multilinear extension of F, but whatever. Basically, you want F to be simple enough that that multilinear extension evaluation is fast for the verifier.
Got it. Because there
are some functions F where that multilinear extension evaluation would be like extraordinarily expensive. And so it's a very technical notion of simple.
So it's something like, if I may, it's like the support of, so it's the number of non-zero coefficients in the multilinear extension is like the complexity of the function that we care about here. Is that right?
Or
is
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be in like, you know, it could be in any basis, you know, coefficients in whatever basis. It just needs to be some quick evaluation procedure. Having few coefficients in your favorite, you know, basis for multilinear polynomials is one way to do that. Yeah, I mean, you know, it turns out that like all of the tables that we need for Joel to have this property, so no one has to commit to these tables and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like bitwise operations certainly will have this property and things like that.
Right.
But like, yeah, when you could imagine like much more complicated operations to have a sparse basis, you might need like a very complicated basis in which you're doing all of the work in the reduction or something.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And in
to this like new basis.
Exactly. And in a theoretical sense, this is not a practical protocol, but there's like a section buried somewhere in the Lasso paper. like just sort of any function with small circuit complexity, it has some reasonably low degree extension that can be quickly evaluated.
I believe that.
Right.
I was gonna say, this feels like right up your OG alley, right? Like this is like defining the complexity of this feels like
So this has always been a sign of a thorn in my side where, you know, my favorite protocol is like sort of for the verifier to be fast, you either need like the multilinear extension. Like I said, things get nice for the prove if you use multilinear extensions. But the verifier is going to be fast mainly if the multilinear extension is quickly evaluable. But what does it mean for the multilinear extension to be quickly evaluable? And, you know, explaining this to people has, you know, been a 15-year, you know, thorn. but it's very related to, you know, how like error constraint systems are sort of by design, like very structured so that the polynomials capturing the constraint system are quickly evaluable. This is like completely analogous to that. Yeah, that's the gist.
Okay. Got it.
Cool. Let's go into Jolt a little deeper. You sort of put it in the same category as the risk zero ZKVM. You didn't mention it, but it would be similar to the SP1 Syncs VM. It's funny, like, I'm not actually sure. Like, is Jolt the name of the ZKVM, or is it the name of the SNARK system that you've actually created? Like, is there any sort of, because, like, for example, SP1, we know, is using Plonky 3. I actually don't know what Risk Zero is using. I'm guessing Grail 16.
It's a combination of a bunch of stuff, I think.
Okay, so firstly, so Risk Zero applies a SNARK that they implemented sort of themselves to an error capturing, you know, the RISC-V CPU that, you know, they also like implemented themselves, right? SP1 feeds an error that I guess they implemented themselves, I think building on some other projects as well. They feed it to Plonky 3, and then Plonky 3 is sort of the Stark for the error, the Stark backend for the error that they feed to Plonky 3.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With Jolt, I would say Jolt is like the ZKVM, but like agnostic to, it's really the polynomial IOP in the ZKVM, if you will. So, you know, I'm very happy to switch the polynomial commitment scheme in Jolt, you know, to something like Binius, say, and still call it Jolt. I'll call it Jolt with Binius instead of Jolt with, you know, Hyrax commitment or Zeromorph commitment or something like that. So Jolt is really the polynomial IOP, you know, capturing the RISC-V, CPU execution. And I can go into a little more detail about how that polynomial IOP works and, you know, kind of how it compares to SP1s and risk zeros, if that would be helpful.
Would you say that's where a lot of the work that you've, like the sort of innovation is on this polynomial IOP side of things?
Yeah, I mean, Jolt really just is a polynomial IOP and like plug in whatever commitment scheme you want to turn that polynomial IOP into a SNARK.
Interesting.
What are the differences, right? Like what is the difference between kind of sticking a big brain RISC-V virtual machine into like some like horrible representation versus this? Like why is this representation so nice? Like I will ask very dumb questions, but I'm just curious on this one.
Let me give a brief overview of the Jolt polynomial IOP and sort of compare it to, you know, the pre-existing, you know, ZKVMs and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just as a CPU contains several components, like so does Jolt, like really mirroring those components. And, you know, I think the other ZKVMs probably function in a similar way as well. So, you know, a CPU just repeatedly runs like fetch, decode, execute, fetch, decode, execute, fetch, decode, execute, right? And then the only other thing going on in a CPU is like reads and writes to random access memory, basically.
There's some registers in there too, but I don't think you have those in the ZKVM.
Yeah, no, we do. We do. So RISC,
oh, you do? Okay, RISC, okay.
Yeah. So RISC-V has 32 registers, like, you know, so we have to support.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
So the registers are part of like the fetch decode, you know, the execute is telling you like, you know, what are the source registers for the instruction? What's the destination register? You know, where should the output of the instruction be saved and stuff?
Yeah. People usually have been, I know they stick those in RAM somewhere instead of actually having like some dedicated.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So ultimately, like, you know, the SNARK techniques we have to, you know, verify that the registers are being read and written correctly, like are really no more efficient, you know, waving my hands a little, than just general random access memory. So like, there's not really a reason to separate the registers from the rest of memory necessarily.
There
are some in the weeds reasons that you can benefit from that. But anyway, yeah, so Jolt has the following components. Firstly, the newest thing in Jolt, I would say, albeit sort of the one I'm tied to like the least in sort of my personal, you know, hopes and dreams or whatever, is the handling the execute part. We do it purely with the lasso lookup argument. Mm, okay, so we say like, if you need to evaluate this instruction on, you know, these inputs X and Y, we just treat that as a lookup into like the evaluation table for that instruction, which is exactly this view I was saying, where, you know, lookup arguments are great for evaluating the same simple function over and over and over again, right? What does the CPU do? Execute, mm-hmm. right? So it's a match made in heaven. So that's how we handle execute, is just straight up lasso. Mm-hmm. You know, this lookup table is enormous size, you know, 264, 228, but it's so structured that no one ever materializes the whole table and so forth. And people were already doing similar things, just without quite this perspective and without using sum check, which I think is key to the, you know, getting the prover performance really high. So that is one part of Jolt. We handle sort of the random access memory with what's called offline memory checking techniques, which also are quite popular already today. But we implement those offline memory checking techniques with sum check. We particularly use something from SPICE, which is a variant of something from Spartan. Anyway, finally, I'd say we handle like the fetch. Fetch is again like memory checking. We handle the decode part with R1CS. So we have this constraint system, which again, it's like a sort of minimal constraint system. There's something like 40-ish constraints per step of the CPU. And I think there's like 80 witness elements, and they're all very small committed per step of the CPU. And that's sort of doing things like, you know, if you fetch the program counter from the right memory cell, like you then have to sort of decompose it into several different fields or something, and making sure we do the decompositions right. That's the gist. So that's all a Jolt. And I would say the main differences over, you know, like existing ZKVMs in my view, like, of course, I think, you know, the fact that it uses the sum check protocol to like everywhere, you know, to minimize, you know, especially the amount of data committed by the prover is, you know, that's really what, you know, what I'm like sort of personally connected to, like what I feel like the main takeaway I want from people to take from Jolt. The other things I'd say is it does more, it's sort of everything is like this very minimal R1CS and offline memory checking. Everything is offline memory checking other than the R1CS. So that's a powerful thing, I think. I mean, that's where we get like, you know, you can specify a new instruction for your instruction set just with like very few lines of Rust code. That's just like very human readable, specifying, you know, how you sort of decompose, you know, executing the instruction into executing sort of instructions on smaller inputs or something like that. So I think that's valuable, but like, you know, there's no, so I want to be clear about something, I guess, doing everything through lookups, which under the hood is offline memory checking, at least as the way Jolt and Lasso do lookups. I think that's very powerful. I think for some instructions, there's more performance to be had by going through a circuit implementation of the instruction. Mm-hmm. I think in most cases, that performance overhead may not be worth the extra complication. It's like very, very clean and simple to just do everything through these lookups. So I don't necessarily think like people will only do things through lookups like forever and ever from now on when they design ZKVMs.
Sure.
But there are definitely benefits to doing it that way. It's definitely nice and clean and simple.
You talk about designing a lot of this system around some checks. Does that sort of hint that like one could also design a lot of systems, like these systems around another paradigm? Like, could it be a folding-based ZKVM? Like, could you just use another one of these techniques that people like to kind of build around?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing I'd say is like the state-of-the-art folding schemes do use some check in them, right?
Okay.
You know, so that's like Hypernova and, you know, I guess the Protostar like line of work is, you know, doing something some check like, but not literally doing some check. And so I think of some check more as like a hammer. And the main thing to be aware of when you use that hammer is that the polynomials arising like under the hood in your protocol are multilinear or at least multivariate instead of univariate. And that has ramifications both in terms of what commitment schemes you can use. And there's much more subtle ramifications that I think people are slowly starting to understand. It's just a hammer for, you know, designing snarks where the prover commits to minimal amount of data is my view.
Well, I guess what I was trying to say here is like, it's, you know, if you're, it's almost like you choose a track and then you build around that track. I do kind of wonder if you could, like, is there a chance for you to share with existing ZKVMs and the ones that are like with the RISC-V instruction set? Yeah. Can you actually like mix and match? You sort of mentioned that you could maybe use Binius instead of what you have right now. But like how much overlap in what exists out there is there with Jolt? Or did you have to build it again, basically? Did you have to redo the whole thing?
Yeah. So I think you basically do have to redo the whole thing, which is why it's, you know, it was a heavy lift for Sam and Michael and Arisu to build this proof system. Like they really couldn't reuse much of anything. Fortunately, they were able to start from Arcworks and Spartan, but you know, nothing else really. You know, some curve libraries too. I guess it's a little hard to explain, but like the, you know, the fact that the polynomial IOP is just different, you know, it means you kind of have to start from scratch. The components of the proof system are the same. Like there is a polynomial IOP, there is a polynomial commitment scheme, right? But the polynomial IOP is totally different. And the commitment scheme needs to be at least a little bit different because it's multilinear instead of univariate polynomials. Right. And this is maybe this is in the weeds, but like people have been trying to like use Fry as a multilinear polynomial commitment scheme, you know, so that they can glue things better, you know, together better. Right. Mm-hmm. And actually, an aside, but like I'll take this as an opportunity to revisit. I was saying before, I think there's more agreement out there than kind of the Twitter discourse might lead people to believe. So there's a new proof system, STWO, that Starkware is working on, right?
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
There were just some new numbers presented at the recent, you know, ZK Summit, and there was a ZK Accelerate event right after that. So I was looking at the STU numbers, right? And like in my blog post about Jolt, I had a pretty lengthy discussion about whether, you know, something like a proof system like SP1 would be able to do recursion efficiently if using like a snark unfriendly hash function. And I was expressing concern that this like recursion, you know, with something like Blake as the hash function would be too slow and would bottleneck the prover. And in the presentation about STU, one of the presentations, there were very, very, very good numbers reported for proving Blake. And I was worried all of a sudden, like, what, you know, did I miss something? You know, have I, you know, like underestimated like the performance of some proof systems? But it, you know, there was Twitter discussion, like STU is apparently getting mileage out of using a lookup argument that is using the SumCheck protocol that was inspired by Lasso and quite similar in many ways to Lasso. And so actually, you know, these good performance results are consistent with like what I was saying in the blog post is I think you'll need the SumCheck protocol to prove these hash functions fast enough that you can do recursion quickly. And so there isn't actually any disagreement here. I agree with everything.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like, you know, in my view, like the key components of Jolt are just like everything. It's like kind of exploiting some check to minimize how much data the prover commits to. And then it's handling as much as possible with offline memory checking based lookups. And you know, I'm more tied to the sum check part than to the lookup part. I think they're both powerful. Yeah. So that's my view of what Jolt is and how it compares to the existing proof systems. And there are ways to glue it together because like the stew is like, it's only using sum check, I think, in the lookups, right? Everything else is based on, you know, Starks and univariate polynomials. So there are ways to do it, but like, I'm hoping the community sort of fully embraces sum check and like
sum check.
Yeah. Sum check through and through. It's not just one component of the proof system, if that makes sense.
Interesting. What's the plan for something like Jolt? So you've like done an implementation. Actually, I mean, this was interesting because you announced it last year. And then just recently, actually, I think the day of the ZK Summit, we saw the announcement for Jolt again. But I was like, I wasn't clear when I saw that. I was like, what is that? And I guess that was the implementation. That was like, this mm-hmm. is now ready to use. But what is, mm-hmm. I mean, is this just like an open source library that you're sharing? What are you doing with it?
Yeah, so it is just open source. You know, it's for anyone to use and build on. I mean, there's a lot of building left to do. So right now it is, you know, there's not what's called continuations implemented, right? So it takes like the entire execution trace of the RISC-V program and it just like proves it all at once. And that's very space intensive for the prover. So what people will typically do is they'll chunk up the execution into smaller pieces and kind of prove each piece separately and aggregate the results. So, you know, we don't have any of that implemented yet. We want to, you know, switch the Binius to the commitment scheme over to Binius and all sorts of other stuff. So there's a lot left to build. We're kind of still figuring out the best way to go through that long process. And, you know, we're hoping that the community as a whole will, you know, contribute. And really, I think the initial version of Jolt that we just released, like there weren't great ways for the community at large to get involved. It sort of just needed like a core team to get it to this point. But I think now there's sort of, you know, a more modular path forward. So we'll hopefully figure that out. But no, yeah, it's very important to us that this is kind of open source. And you know, eventually, you know, the small team that reached this point just like can't build all of it and can't like keep doing this forever and ever. So it's very important that sort of the community, you know, as a whole kind of get involved and eventually probably take ownership in some way. We'll see.
Well, I'm kind of curious why it's coming out of A16Z research. That was also a thing where I was like, you guys are building stuff and it's open source, you're sharing it, but like, do you imagine spinning it out into something, or is it really just like for the teams in your portfolio, or is it just for the community? Yeah, I'm kind of curious how you think about it.
Yeah, no, it's for the community as a whole. I mean, it'll A16Z will never monetize this. Of course, we'd love portfolio companies to use it, but we'd love for everyone to use it. The perspective of people at A16Z is that the firm as a whole sort of succeeds or fails based on the entire ecosystem. You know, it's not about any one project. And so if we can really move the needle for the whole ecosystem by sort of, you know, these sorts of efforts, it's worth it. And so I was very lucky to, you know, join the firm when I did. The engineering team had just gotten built up along with the research team. I managed to get a lot of interest and excitement from Michael and Sam, two of our engineers. You know, they didn't know anything about Snarks. They had to learn it from scratch. It's nice that, you know, I had this book that, you know, they could kind of get like a private pass through the book.
Nice.
I mean, the whole thing has been sort of unbelievable for me that they've managed to pick this up and implement it. And it was like just so much work for them. But yeah, I mean, the hope is that it benefits the whole community and we'll see how it plays out.
I just love this. I can see this. It's like you have been on a mission to make sum check the thing. And you are now getting it into the hands of people in a way I guess you maybe couldn't have imagined like a few years ago, because you were really in that research area where you might have championed it in research, but you need people to implement it and buy in. And here you actually get a chance to see it in
this
action.
This is the like spoon, here comes the airplane to like the child who like doesn't want to be fed. It's like, no, you will be fed some checks.
Right. And I'll say, I mean, you know, this whole effort like would have never happened if, you know, the RISC-V had the foresight to target. I didn't know what RISC-V was when, you know, when RISC-V launched, right? You know, the sort of the interest, the fact that I was able to, you know, take like three engineers' time, because Noah worked on the like the developer interface, which was also a lot of effort. You know, to take all that time from a very small engineering team for like, you know, ultimately like not 10 months if you include Lasso in there, Like, wow. You know, yeah. The fact that just all these projects had already built so much and made so much progress, like it just can't happen without that.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, as just a professor, I think there's no way we could have, I could have gotten the engineering required to just sort of demonstrate that this stuff really, you know, has the benefits that it does. Cause you know, engineering is for, as a researcher, it's like, it's a confounding factor, right? It's like something could be 10 times better sort of intrinsically, but the engineering makes a 20x difference and you can't tell now, you know.
Totally.
it gets eaten up, yeah.
Funny. Was there ever a moment as they were implementing it where you weren't sure if your like results would actually play out? Cause like now you have some metrics that are good, but like, what if they hadn't been?
Yeah. You know, I won't say that I had like no stress at any time. but, you know, like it was always the case that like, so I had very detailed calculations, like largely based on like cycle counts, you know, especially because we're using curve-based commitments, like everything the prover does is like field work or just like, you know, plumbing stuff that, you know, like I sort of ignore in my calculations, right? So either, you know, I was making a mistake in my calculations or the plumbing was just going to be too expensive. And I was pretty sure the plumbing wouldn't be too expensive. So I had like a fundamental misunderstanding and my calculations were missing something really important, or just like the plumbing is overwhelming. And so until I either discovered a really big mistake or the plumbing was just seeming awful, I was not too worried.
You were not worried.
Yeah. But okay, now cool. Michael and Sam suffered through all of this without that faith, right? So I'd say even a month ago, we were 5x, 6x slower than today.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so I'd say we had like a functioning version of Jolt after, like back in December. And so I thought that I was surprised how long it took to get the engineering in the state that it needed to be in. But I never had a doubt it would get there. But like Sam kept saying like, oh, we're going to get like at most another 2x, even back when we were like 10x. And I kept being like, no, we're not.
It's going to be better.
And eventually it was. And you know,
and it was.
Cool.
And it was. And there's still something on the table there. So.
Right. Yeah. It is funny. The engineering does, it's like you can test individual components, but it isn't until you kind of really, really like put all the nuts and bolts together and like really make sure you oil every bearing and stuff that it's like clear that it all works. It's very easy to like jump ahead the five steps, but like there's some real glass chewing that happens in the middle.
Oh yeah. And there, you know, with Jolt, like there's a lot of structure that, you know, existing libraries don't leverage. Like the R1CS we deal with is like super structured, super, you know, and Spartan was made to handle arbitrary R1CS. And we were just like, it was 60 times too slow to begin with. And, you know, it took a while to figure out exactly why it was quite so bad, you know, what structure it was missing and things like that. So
yeah, it's like materializing the matrices in like one row order versus column order will screw you if they're spot, you know, like, like this is the kind of stuff that's like, oh, like, yeah, I mean, of course it's like, if you do it right, it's going to work, but but takes real glass chewing.
Right. And I don't want to minimize, like, that stuff is super important.
Yep.
But I think there is a perspective out there that, like, you just can't know how these things will run till you build it because of stuff like this. And I think that's too strong. I mean, you know, it's always possible. I just got lucky with Jolt and, like, you know, this stuff didn't turn into, like, a sticking point that kept us from getting where I thought we would go. But, you know, my general sense, though, is that with enough glass chewing, you will get where you think you're going if your calculations were detailed enough to figure out where you think you're going. And that has been my experience so far.
Cool. I really see this, Justin, now as like this mission, just this like force of will to get this sum check out there in the world. You did it. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. I definitely could not have done it without a lot of help along the way. So let me express appreciation to everyone. And I think at this point, I get to work with lots of new people who, you know, weren't working on sum check before. And you know, that's super fun. And you know, I feel much better. I feel like I could disappear today and the community will wind up in a great place. You know, there's so much ability and motivation and capability out there.
For
and,
sure.
You know, I've been trying to sort of just point it in what I think is the right direction. And I feel like it's pointed now. And that's great. The process can just play out.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Justin, for coming on the show and sharing with us what you've been up to since last year. going through the 17 or some of the 17 misconceptions about snarks, and then sharing with us Lasso and then now Jolt, and basically your mission to get some check into the hands of as many people as you can get it into. I love it. So cool.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, super, super fun. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. I want to say thank you to the podcast team, Rachel, Henrik, and Tanya, and to our listeners. Thanks for listening.